This podcast is sponsored by FATT, F-A-T-T, a range of keto on-the-go snacks, including cookies, brownies, chocolate bites, bars, Fat Jacks, and muffins. FATT snacks are delicious, natural, and always free from sweeteners, fillers, and seed oils. Find FATT snacks at www.livefatt.com. That's LIVEFATT.com. Use the code FABULOUSLY10, that's 10, to give an extra 10% off one-time purchases, not valid on subscribe and save. Support the Fabulously Keto podcast and join me in my mission to bring the knowledge of health and well-being to the world so that men and women can make many meaningful changes in their lives. Every podcast episode gives people the chance to learn and improve their health, and I want to be able to continuously deliver fabulous content. Each episode needs resources, inviting and coordinating with our generous guests, conducting and recording inspiring interviews, bringing you fully edited interviews, crafting episode artwork, engaging our audience through social media content, including visuals, content, and audio clips, sharing across various social media platforms, ensuring our dedicated subscribers receive timely newsletters. Your support is pivotal in sustaining the Fabulously Keto podcast. Whether through a one-time contribution or a recurring monthly pledge, start from as little as $1 or £1. Every bit counts. I understand our community spans the globe, and for this reason, I offer payment options in both US dollars or British pounds. Whilst we do have a sponsor for the podcast, that goes only partway to covering some of the costs, and I'm really grateful to FATT for their assistance and their support. There are additional costs, including my time investment, which still have to be covered by me. Your support bridges this gap and ensures that I can continue to deliver premium content without compromise. To see the ways that you can support us, go to fabulouslyketo.com/podcast. But I'd really like to take a few seconds to tell you about our Super Fabulously Keto supporter option. This costs £10 or $12.50 a month. And as a Super Fabulously Keto supporter, you'll get your name mentioned at the top of the show. You'll get access to the podcast before it's released for general listening with reduced intros and outro messages. You'll be part of a private Facebook group exclusively for Super Fabulously Keto supporters, where you can share with other members and make friends. And you'll be invited to our monthly group Zoom calls with me, where we'll discuss topics, answer questions, and hold each other accountable to goals. Topics will cover real food, low carb, intermittent fasting, extended fasting, keto, and carnivore. You'll be able to try different protocols to move the needle on your journey. So that is available also from our Fabulously Keto page, support. So that's fabulouslyketo.com/support. I really appreciate any support you can give.
Welcome to the Fabulously Keto podcast, aimed at improving health, vitality, and quality of life. Eating real food in a ketogenic lifestyle. I'm Jackie Fletcher, and I'm based in the UK.
And I'm Louise Reynolds, an Aussie currently based in Bangkok, Thailand.
Each week, we will be bringing you guests who share their stories and discuss a range of topics which we hope will improve your health and well-being.
Many of the guests, like us, came to keto for weight loss and have stayed for their well-being, numerous health benefits, and because they are living their best lives. We hope you will be inspired to incorporate these ideas into your own health journey so that you can feel better than you ever have before.
Thinking about starting keto? Take a listen to episode number 2, What is Keto and How to Start?
Welcome to episode 187 of the Fabulously Keto podcast. And first of all, I've got to give a shout out to Louise Benning, one of our super fabulously keto supporters. Great to have you on board, Louise. And before I get to today's guests, I have something special to announce. Last year, Geraint Hole and I were discussing putting together a fabulously keto club, and we came up with some great ideas, but then it stalled for a bit. Last week, I met this crazy Canadian who was talking about the magic of bringing a group of amazing, like-minded people together who share similar passions. And in hearing him talking about bringing this group of people together, it got me thinking about you. It got me thinking about what it might be like if we were to create a group of people passionate about health with the goal of working towards metabolic health and growing old healthily with a strong body and a strong mind. Now, I've got some ideas. As I said, we did discuss it last year, but I don't have any of the details figured out yet. It's just an idea. But the idea gets me really excited. Here's what gets me excited when I think about a community of people committed to and dedicated towards not only a healthy body and mind for themselves, but also the wider community. I don't think of the great conversations, the incredible support and the camaraderie. What I think about is the ripple effect of what will happen in people's lives as we are all working towards metabolic health. I see a community of people who, instead of feeling lonely because they're the only ones in their household who is eliminating processed food and caring about their health, they are feeling supported and encouraged. I see a community that, instead of feeling frustrated and confused, they're feeling clear and confident. And when I think about the ripple effect of people moving from feeling overwhelmed with all the information to feeling like they have a direction and a path to follow, I think about the knock-on effect in their families. If you are feeling lonely, overwhelmed, and frustrated, you're likely to snap at your loved ones and make life more difficult, where none of you are enjoying life. As you find clarity, calmness, with a community that is supporting you, you're going to be able not only to respond to your family in a loving and kind way, you're going to feel empowered and confident to spread the word to others. And we are going to impact even more lives. Now, although I haven't created anything yet, I'm so excited about the potential of creating this amazing community because I know what is going to make possible in people's lives. I've seen a smaller version in our carnivore challenge, and I'm so excited to be able to personally interact with this group of founding members, especially in the early days. Together, we are going to be helping shape the direction of this fabulous community. I can't wait to a year from now, or 3 years from now, or 5 years from now, and we're all looking back and saying, we were part of the original group who started this amazing community. And that is why I want to invite you to come and join us as a founding member. And I want to extend to you founding member pricing, which will be the lowest it's ever going to be. Because when I do this launch to the general public, the price will immediately go up. As a founding member, your price will stay locked in at the low founding member rate. The big benefit for you at getting in on the ground floor is that you lock in this low founding member rate of £25 or $32 for as long as you remain a member in good standing. I also want your feedback. In the beginning, this group is going to be much more intimate. It's going to give me a chance to interact with you. I will be able to learn from and listen to you. And you're going to be able to give me your feedback and help shape the direction that we take this community. I'm thrilled to open up these founding member slots, and I would love to invite you to come and join us. If you're interested in becoming a founding member, these slots are only going to be available at these prices until Wednesday, the 17th of April, 2024. So if you're interested, just send an email to hello@fabulouslyketo.com and say, I'm in. And just let me know if you want to pay in pounds, British pounds, or American dollars. So now let me tell you about today's guest. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Naysha Winters. My friend and podcast guest, Maya Sutherland, met Naysha last summer and introduced us. Naysha was due to record with me last year, but had to cancel because she was travelling on the day we had organised. Thanks to Hannah from FAT, I got to meet Naysha last September at a small gathering in Mayfair in London. And Joanne McManamy, her friend Suzanne and I went to the gathering. In the podcast, when I first said her name, I said Naysha with a soft A, but it's actually Naysha. I also forgot to ask where in the world she was. Probably because we chatted offline and she told me that they have moved to Mexico and she was in Mexico. I would recommend that you find the link in the show notes for the test that Naysha mentioned so that you can find out where you are and where you can improve yourself to avoid getting cancer. And if people already have it, then to find out where they need to make changes. So let me tell you about Naysha. Dr. Naysha Winters is a global healthcare authority and best-selling author in integrative cancer care and research consulting with physicians around the world. She has educated hundreds of professionals in the clinical use of mistletoe and has created robust educational programs for both healthcare institutions and the public on incorporating vetted integrative therapies in cancer care to enhance outcomes. Dr. Winters is currently focused on opening a comprehensive metabolic oncology hospital and research institute in the US, where the best that standard of care has to offer and the most advanced integrative therapies will be offered. This facility will be a residential setting on a gorgeous campus against a backdrop of regenerative farming, EMF mitigation and retreat, as well as a state-of-the-art medical technology and data collection and evaluation to improve patient outcomes. So let's go and hear from Naysha. Welcome, Dr. Naysha, to the Fabulously Keto podcast. It's fabulous to have you with us today.
Oh, it's fabulous to be here. Thank you so much, Jackie.
Well, it's taken us a while to get it together because we had to reschedule, but we're here now.
Yes.
And it's worked out quite well because I recently interviewed Robin Daly.
Yay!
And I've got Pete coming on. So we'll have a whole cancer section.
Yes. Go, girl. That's awesome.
Yeah. So why don't you start by telling us your journey and how you came to where you are today?
Sure. I think a lot of folks think, oh, you got involved in the cancer space and what brought you into that? And I think that a lot of folks, you know, it's not like we woke up one day and said, God, I think I'll work with cancer. Anybody who's in this environment working with patients with cancer have likely had a very compelling story or reason or experience or loved one or personal that has gone through this process. And so I'm no different than any of my other colleagues who've landed in the, you know, oncology space. You know, I know that, you know, like you said, you interviewed Dr. or that you interviewed recently, Robin Daly from Yes to Life, you know, his passion path, you know, pain to purpose came from this, you know, personal experience with a loved one. Patricia, you know, she'll be, you know, Pete will be telling you her story as to what brought her into this arena. She also worked as an oncology nurse forever, which made her really realize, hey, there's limitations in that place that we can definitely do a lot better. So thank God she, you know, has the biggest, best kind of broad stroke picture of that to come from. And so for me, it was a personal journey with this. And you and I were talking before the recording about you were even younger when you had a you know, what was thought of or that you were told was a benign tumor process, but your sister says, au contraire, mon frère, it was actually malignant, that you had a big old massive tumor yourself on an ovary process at a young age, at the age of 18. I had a similar experience when I was 19. And yet for me, by the time they figured it out, it was too far gone. And it was indeed malignant and on a runaway train throughout my whole body. Because of my metabolic brokenness and my autoimmune patterns and my traumas and my dietary and lifestyle and my toxicant exposures and all kinds of things that I can now in retrospect understand, all of my symptoms were completely missed. They were just like, oh, it's just your IBS flaring. Oh, it's just your endometriosis flaring. Oh, it's just your anxiety flaring. Oh, it's just your rheumatoid arthritis flaring. Oh, it's just you, you know, oh, you have a UTI now for this. We'll just give you an antibiotic. Oh, now you have a yeast infection. We'll give you a, I mean, it was just this whack-a-mole game. And so by the time I did land in the emergency room, my roommate found me, you know, mostly unconscious, a whole slew of things later, organ failure, grapefruit sized tumor in my right ovary, bowel obstruction, end-stage organ failure, belly filled with fluid, in places where fluid should not be, no oxygen in my body. I mean, you name it, I was as close to death as you could possibly get without actually crossing over. And so because of that, there was no options. I was too sick, too far gone for them to offer a standard of care. So they sent me immediately to palliative care. At that time in my community in 1991, there wasn't really, the hospice movement wasn't, had not landed in my community, but that would be what they would have sent me off to. Fast forward, here we are 32 plus years later, by the time this recording goes live, I'm still here, still figuring it out for myself and for the hundreds of thousands of patients I've either directly or indirectly supported throughout my career. And it has been the biggest gift, the biggest teacher, the biggest messenger, and the biggest call to action and the biggest pain to purpose process I could have ever imagined. Despite the fact, I will tell your listeners, that when I finally ended up in medical school, I was never going to work with cancer at all. Like, that was not the plan. In fact, my first plan was to deal with the emotional toxicity and trauma and make sense of that, which was, I thought I was going to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist and go into the counseling world. That quickly left the building when I realized that, and this is going to probably piss off a lot of your listeners, but I worked in a psych unit. I worked as a CNA in a psychiatric unit. I worked as a detox counselor. I had a certification as a detox counselor in my community because there was a detox unit attached to the psych hospital. And I will tell you right now that it was very difficult to decide who needed to be in lockdown. Was it the psychiatrist or the patient? So there was more of a, and I believe that there's that concept of healer heal thyself, that we're drawn to the things that we need. And so it was notorious that I realized I am surrounded by just as many, and not more, crazy people now in this industry than I was in my life and in my home. So I thought, nope, I'm going to leave that. And then I thought, maybe I'll go and be a midwife, because I don't want to see the end of life. I want to see the beginning of life. And then I realized I would never sleep, because those little buggers are not born between like 9 and 5 every day. So after 36 babies, I was like, I'm going to hang up that hat and love the life experience and really enjoy it. But man, it's, you know, I bow down to people in obstetrics and gynecology, as well as the midwifery world. You are one special animal to be disrupting your circadian rhythm as deeply as that. But that's where, when I first got into private practice, I was just going to do general family. And my first week of private practice, this man was drawn in a wheelchair, the parietal bone bulging out of his head, unable to talk, drooling down his face, wearing a diaper, in excruciating pain with no amount of opiates soothing that pain. His imaging showed that his ventricles of his brain had shut down, so there was no more pumping of cerebral spinal fluid. He was literally within hours, if not days. They gave him weeks he didn't have weeks with a shutdown ventricles of life and came in for end of life pain management support. He died 18 months later. And with his family by his side, he'd gotten to go and take a drive in the mountains. He'd spent the majority of that 18 months out of his wheelchair, out of his diaper, completely having a quality of life. And one of the things I applied to him when he first came into the office was no amount of pain meds were touching the pain. So we did acupuncture and homeopathy for that. I worked even in a very conventional neurology office and they had no tools. So they were so like, have at it, you crazy naturopath, let's see what happens. And I was able to get through the pain. But the other thing that wasn't working in standard of care were the medications for his seizures, of which he was having over 100 grand mal seizures a day, thanks to the tumor burden in his brain. He had glioblastoma that was inoperable and not radiation, not in a region of his brain that he could radiate. And he refused any more care and they didn't offer any more care. He was definitely at the end of the road. And so the one thing I knew at that time was ketogenic diet, because we'd used it safely in pediatrics in the early 1920s, to apply it to a grown man. I thought, what harm is this going to do? No expectation that it would take away his pain, that it would take the swelling down to the point where his head looked normalized again, that he would be able to recover his speech, his movements, his ability to walk and ability to live a lot longer with a quality of life that literally his last day on this earth was a drive in the mountains with his family, looking at the fall colors and going to bed that night with his family wrapped around him in bed and not waking up. That's pretty incredible. And so lo and behold, in my small town, mountain town, a lot of people caught wind of my abilities to support people in the cancering process. And I suddenly became known for that in my community, no matter how much I wanted to fight it. It wasn't until 2012 that someone had me speak at an ovarian cancer summit in Colorado. And that ended up basically, long story short, putting my small little clinic in Durango, Colorado, and my reputation on the map globally. And now every single person with ovarian cancer from all over the world seemed to know who I was and wanted to get in to see me. And just to give your listeners context, there's about 24,000 women a year diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and about 17,000 of those die. So it's a relatively small group of people. They're scrappy, they're resourceful, they're resilient, and they find each other to support each other through this because the standard of care model has failed them miserably. And so they went outside the boundaries to find other ways to support themselves. And that's what has led to now 12 years later, I had to shut down my practice to anybody outside of oncology just to meet the demand then. So that's sort of the big picture of what landed me in the oncology space, despite my resistance to it. When you've had it yourself, I also kept my own diagnosis very, very private until about 2012. And then I was still private about the details of that until I left practice in 2015. And I was really still pretty quiet about it until after my book came out in 2017, when I felt like I was in enough of an environment as a consultant, no longer as a practitioner, that I could offer things and say things that I was not allowed to ever say as a doctor. It's really sad. I also was very, very clear with folks that what worked for me and what is still working for me and what I'm continuing to learn for myself does not apply to everybody. I am 100% proponent of the N of one and the personalized approach to this, and that you could put 10 women with ovarian cancer of my demographic and my age and my tumor type and the whole thing in the same room, and we'd all have a different reason for getting there. And we'd all have a different neat and different approach to how we get out of there. And so that's something that I've also mastered in this methodology of this test and assess before you address, don't guess approach, which helps me really determine the right, like what led somebody to be in front of me or one of the doctors I've trained, and what are the tools and resources to help them recover their wellness.
Yeah. So what was your journey, your way out? Because it sounds like you were not going anywhere at that time.
Yeah. Well, I didn't expect to live, but they told me they gave me 3 months. And so instead of saying I'm going to fight this, because I had no belief system, I had no expectation. There was no Dr. Google in 1991. There was nobody practicing integrative anything. In 1991, it was super underground. I didn't have an expectation of living through it. So what I chose, the area I chose to put my attention on, was I want to understand why a 19-year-old would have this. Because at that time in 1991, it was certainly not normal nor common. Today, it's still not normal, but unfortunately, it's a lot more common 32 plus years later. But even then, I'm like, this, something's not right here. And I knew my family history. I knew my, the genetics of my family, or the, not the genetics, the diagnosis history, the family history. And I knew there was a ton of cancer in my family, but even then it was relatively rare. Back in 1991, I would go to, like when I was in med school, or I'd go to a medical conference, or I would even speak at a, you know, present at a medical conference, even upwards until about 10, 15 years ago, I would say, how many of you have been personally touched by cancer? And maybe the first 10 years, it was maybe 10% of the room would raise their hand. And by 20 years ago, maybe 50% raised their hand. I have to actually ask that question differently today. I now have to say, how many of you have not been directly touched by cancer? And now there might be a handful of hands that go up in that room. That's in a 30-year span.
Yeah.
Something's really wrong there. And so when it comes back to me and what I did, it's not about a did, it's an ongoing, it's a still I'm doing. And so standard of care would likely not consider me free of disease. Standard of care's metrics for determining if you are cured or not is what's going on in your tumor testing, your tumor metrics, your tumor, your cancer tumor test. So for ovarian cancer, for instance, it's mostly the CA125, cancer antigen 125 is the typical blood test they like to run for that. You might also have heard of the HE4, which is human epididymis 4 protein. And then sometimes you'll see a CEA, which is a carcinoembryo antigen, that is a kind of a more general test. But all three of those were off the charts for me. My CA125 at the time of diagnosis was over 15,000. Up until about a year, year and a half ago, my test was never normal on a CA125, 30 plus years later. So standard of care would have said, you're cancering, right? Hmm. On imaging, my last, because I destroyed my kidneys, thank you MRIs and contrast dye, I can't do contrast of any kind. It is not able to do. So I monitor with vaginal ultrasounds, and I monitor with thermography. And now that we have access to tools like Prenuvo and Ezra and a few other tests out there, which are MRIs that do not use radiation or contrast dye. And thank God I couldn't do contrast dye, because it also kept me out of all the radiation of CT scans and PET scans when those started to come into vogue in the 90s at the early stages of my diagnosis. I also didn't find out till 96 that I was BRCA positive. And people with BRCA mutation, ATM mutation, Lynch mutation, we are very, 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 very vulnerable to radiation. BRCA mutations, ATM Lynch mutations, these are DNA repair problems. And the very thing that destroys our DNA and makes that repair even worse is ionizing radiation. Hmm. And so the sickest, saddest effing thing we do to patients with those things is we scan the crap out of them every 6 months. If you want to make job security for me, that's what you do, right? We as patients need to demand a non-ionizing radiation, especially for those familial mutations, because of our vulnerable genetics, our vulnerable DNA protection and repair. And so thank God I couldn't tolerate those because of the contrast dye that would not do those at that time. They wouldn't even think about doing those types of imaging without the contrast dye. So I went a different direction. Thank God today we have tools that are non-radiating and non-contrast dye that are just as sensitive and specific. And those are popping up more and more, but a lot of patients will never know about them because they're not covered by insurance. But when your life depends on it, you will always find a way to save your own. My patients call it my Save Your Ass University, SYA University. I think I've got a couple of doctorates from there now, and have helped many other people achieve their own doctorate from that same university over the years of knowing we had to do things differently. So for me, standard of care would say, hey, you still have lesions in your liver, you still have peritoneal implants, you still have carcinomatosis, you still have a tumor in your right ovary. They would never say, I'm cancer-free. And I'm here to also drop the bomb, the truth bomb, into your community that none of us are cancer free ever. That's not a reality that will ever happen for any of us, including our pets, including our animals, as I'm looking at my dog sound asleep on the couch behind me here. And that we all have cancer in our body at all times, but our bodies are designed to be able to see it, respond to it, and rid of it or maintain it, keep it in a sort of a symbiotic space. And so it's when we lose that, what I call the three R's, the recognition, the response, and the remembering, when we lose that part of our immune function, that's when cancer cells can get on the move. And so I've spent the last 30 plus years learning how to manage this process in my body versus destroy or wage war on or go and remove all evidence of disease. In that, I've learned to have a very different relationship with the understanding of cancer metabolism and cancer physiology, and even the psychology around the cancering process, to understand that cancer is not the enemy, and to understand that it's a messenger, and that it has had a lot to teach me and a lot for me to teach into the world. And it's not a very popular notion, as you can imagine, because we've built an entire industry on this concept of waging war, and that it's somehow we're unlucky, or that it's somehow just Russian roulette, and that there's nothing we can do, and that it's just our genetics, despite the fact that science will tell you less than 5% of it's genetic. And even that 5%, we can do something about. But the 95%, we actually can do something about. We aren't helpless, and there's a lot we can do. So for me, I'm continually learning on how to nourish my terrain, to evaluate my terrain, and to know what my blind spots are, to know what my obstacles are, and to address them. So I don't put myself in harm's way. I'm very thoughtful about what I feel, what I think, what I eat, what I breathe, what I put on and in and around my body. I have to. I'm like your canary in the coal mine in this lifetime to know what is causing my body harm. And I do labs very routinely to get that feedback. I know my body very well to know how it's responding to things. And I teach others to do the same, whether I'm teaching clinicians to know how to do this for themselves and their patients, or directly to the patients when I was in private practice, or even now to our patient advocates, who now we also train, who are like that beautiful bridge between patient and doctor. And most of those folks are people who themselves were a patient or a caregiver, that were able to walk that process, walk that journey, and see what it is I'm talking about. I'm not just making this stuff up, right? It's not that esoteric, really, at the end of the day.
Yeah. So what are, I guess you said for everybody, the why it will come about is different for everyone. Yeah. But are there some common threads that will pull together that people can think, maybe that's why, or, you know. And then the other question was, which I probably should have asked before, is why children so young? Why do they, because if we're talking about metabolic disease, that usually takes a long time to manifest. Why are children suffering quite early on in their lives?
Well, let's start there. Let's just go ahead and come, because I get attacked on a regular basis by people who are like, how dare you blame the child for stress response or trauma when they clearly haven't had any trauma, or somehow you're insinuating that I caused my child's cancer. First of all, no. Like, you cannot even put that on me if you tried. That is not at all what I'm ever saying. That is not what we're insinuating. I want folks to think about this. Each and every one of us standing here, okay, we are three generations, all right? Women are three generations. So my grandmother, in her ovaries, in her eggs, was my mother. And inside that was me. That contribution. Yep. All right. My brother is the result of those three generations. I'm the result of those three generations, and it perpetuates down. So that's something that people need to think about. It does not start in this moment. We now have plenty of data to show that we have epigenetics that we can trace back 12 generations that expresses through us. Now, epigenetics above the gene are also things that we can control the expression of.
Yeah.
So you come from a long line of people like, oh, my dad had diabetes, my grandpa had diabetes, my great-grandpa had diabetes, I'm going to have diabetes. No, if you choose to do the same things they did, you will have diabetes, right? Yeah. So there's also plenty of studies showing that the diet of the father will impact the child's cancer risk. There's plenty of studies showing that women who smoked during pregnancy, their daughters have a higher incidence of ovarian cancer. So I get to blame my mom on this one. She used to joke that I would kick the ashtray off her belly. Now, that is obviously not the one thing, right? But those are just examples that we do have plenty of data. But what people don't remember is that every umbilical cord today tests on average 200 chemicals. Most of those are known carcinogens.
Yeah.
So we live in a toxic soup. And think about your littles. Think about these little beings. When we talk about, like, we're out in the, like, out in nature, we talk about the solution to pollution is dilution. You don't get that luxury when you're a very small, compact, distilled essence of a little person.
Mm.
So what your mother or your father or another adult might be able to tolerate as an exposure to a certain chemical, a certain toxin, you as a little being don't. You just concentrate it.
Yeah.
And it just takes root. There are so many studies linking, directly linking known carcinogens from our environment to pediatric oncology. There are so many studies linking the use of Tylenol, which your fucking pediatrician, can I say that? You can bleep me if you need to, will tell you to give your child every time they have a fever. There are so many studies. You just go do a PubMed study on the use of acetaminophen and its rate and risk of leukemias.
Wow.
All right. That's not on me. That's on the fact that we've been poisoning our children for generations, even before they were an apple in your mother's eye, right? They've already been exposed to all the changes we've made to our environment, especially since the 1850s, at the introduction of the Industrial Food Revolution, to the 1940s post-World War, where we took all of our leftover ammo and said, hey, let's create agriculture and pharmaceuticals out of this. That changed the game. By the mid-1960s, by the mid-1940s, we started putting moms on DES or different drugs like that to prevent miscarriage. Basically, if you were pregnant before 1960, between 1945 and 1960, you were likely given those drugs and you didn't even know it. And we have all the data showing, they call them DES kids, DES babies. And those babies, though, that generation had higher rates of vulvar cancer, breast cancer, endometrial cancer, and their children have higher incidence of breast and prostate cancer, et cetera. So those were new things we've added to the environment. We started using...
So what was DES? What?
DES is a type of estrogen that was preventing miscarriage. Okay. And they were doing something they thought was good. Right? It ended up kicking up all kinds of downstream effects in the next generation of cancer. And again, your listeners, this isn't a naturopath's ideology. This is well documented in the literature. IARC is a third party investigational review, an international assembly of cancer research that looks at all the data and will show you all of the class 1, 2, and 3 carcinogens. So basically, what are you getting? It's indefinite. We absolutely know this is carcinogenic without fail. To, hey, this is probably carcinogenic, so probably avoid it. And then the 3 is, there's evidence that it's carcinogenic, but we just haven't done the studies. So it kind of gets a little pass, hall pass. That's what they look at. And what's crazy is there's only been 2 studies that have been done, very short term, long time ago, it's been over a decade now, where they said, well, let's take this non-carcinogenic option and let's mix it with this non-carcinogenic chemical. And then guess what? Bada bing, bada boom, we turned it into a carcinogen. We only have 2 studies that have done that. So basically, since the 1960s, we have 80,000 chemicals that have come out or more that have come out into our world that have had less than 200 of those properly tested.
Mm.
And some of them have been probably tested for the interactions between them. The changes in our farming industry, we started dumping glyphosate. Dr. Huber, who's one of my teachers and mentors from Indiana University, started shouting the warning bells in the late 1960s saying, glyphosate is a problem. This is a problem, folks. Now IARC has it as a carcinogen, but the industry is still fighting against that being Bayer/ used to be Monsanto. By the way, your country has decided to let it back in again. Well done. We were hoping that you would help lead the way and keep it from getting back out into the world. But yeah, so it just drives me nuck and futs here. But we definitely have associations of pediatric cancers to glyphosate exposure. If your kid is eating, you know, chickpeas, if they're eating, you know, their bread, they're all those things, they have massive doses of glyphosate. Our first food we give to babies is rice, which is loaded with arsenic, a known carcinogen. I mean, when people say, I don't understand how you're blaming children, you know, like, how could you? I'm like, where do you live on this planet to not understand that you are living in an extremely toxic environment? We need to be doing preconception counseling. We need to be doing preconception cleanup to do the best we can to avoid as much as possible what we're going to pass on to the future generation. And even then, it's a long shot. But how many of us were conceived on probably a night of tequila and, you know, you know, whatever, like no one was thinking about those things. Most of us have entered onto this planet with not a lot of thought behind it, right?
Yeah.
And so we look at these types of things. So when people ask that question, the other thing that has been very shown in the literature is the passing down of generational trauma. So even if that child did not have a direct exposure to trauma, which believe me, we see 2 and 3 year olds who are exhibiting trauma and their bodies are expressing it. I can tell you that from clinical practice over and over. Mother, grandmother, all of those things are passing through. And also the nature of what was happening in the mother's life in the midst of her pregnancy, those stress chemicals are literally changing the whole metabolic expression, the whole immune expression, the whole neuroendocrine expression of the body that comes forth. And then when we are overly sanitized, you know, in those first 2 years, when we overly start to throw chemicals into these babies, I mean, your babies are getting multiple pharmaceuticals and vaccines within hours of them entering this world. And people have the nerve to get pissed when I talk about the toxicity of what's happening. You have to become a savvy consumer. It is not your fault, but you don't know what you know until you know. So if someone gets to this point and they're like, my child has cancer, and they start to find out all the things, what I've found in my practice is people will do one of two things. They will either be like, I didn't know what I know, and now I know, and now I'm a fierce mama bear on a mission, pain to purpose. This ain't never happened in my watch ever again, or anybody else's that I can get within a 10-foot pole of me. The other sad reality are the people who choose to put their heads into the sand. And cognitive dissonance kicks in, and the reality is too painful that they themselves put blame on themselves when they shouldn't. They don't know. But instead of saying, oh my God, I just didn't know, they go in and bite people like me trying to be the messenger.
Yeah.
And that's really unfortunate because we are going extinct, folks. Our statistics are now 1 in 2 of us will experience cancer in our lifetime. And that's, it's now beating cardiovascular disease as the number one cause of death. And World Health Organization shows that cancer rates will double by 2030. That is 6 years from now. And everyone then gets mad at the messengers. There's a great TED talk called Willful Blindness. I cannot remember the name of this woman. People should watch this because people don't like to hear the truth, because it also puts us back into having to be autonomous, personal, you know, taking personal responsibility and taking personal, like we have to like do our own homework. We have to stand up for ourselves because no one is doing it. No one is coming to save us. And so people like myself and people like my colleagues who have all trained, we've now got 250, the time is recording 250 clinicians in 39 countries, over 300 advocates in 39 countries with a whole new cohort of advocates going into training in April. We alone last month, I just got this statistic before coming in, our directory for advocates. So we're thinking, and even on our directory of advocates, we might have, I don't know, 50 that are through the program and feel comfortable to advertise that they do this. And the same thing with our doctors, we might have, I don't know, 70 that feel comfortable to advertise, hang a shingle and say, I do this work. Last month, we had 35,000 inquiries on who to see, who makes this, who does this approach. 35,000. That was just in January.
Wow.
2024.
Wow.
We haven't even known yet. And so once we really get known, we can't meet the demands. So all these patients and all these people waking up, there's no one to serve them.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're waking up, which is a good thing.
Nailed it. Which gives me hope. I think, Jackie, as much as I was just gave this like hard, like reality check, I don't ever tell the bad news without saying there's good news. Like the fact that I'm still standing in front of you 32 years later with a BRCA mutation, with literally multiple times where my candle should have been snuffed, and I'm still figuring it out, kicking the can down the road and figuring it out, kicking the can out and figuring it out and applying it to teaching others to do the same. There are more of us coming out of the woodwork. We are so passionate. It's very hard to kill us. We're like the cockroaches and the coyotes. And so here we are to help, you know, to change this. And though we go against mainstream, we are perceived as other, we are perceived as quacks. The craziest thing is the people that I mostly teach today, and the way I teach is because I am a scientist first. I use the data, not dogma. I'm very much a bridge builder. And most of the people drawn to learning from me are conventional oncologists and conventional MDs. Not who I thought it would be. I thought it'd be all naturopaths and like groovy alternative doctors. No. It's the people jumping off the sinking ship, saying what we're doing isn't working. They're jumping into the life rafts of other ways to think about this and approach this. Thank God.
Yeah. Wow. Yes.
Yes.
I'm really pleased to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because. Well,
yeah. Because we need it.
Lots of doctors will just follow the dogma, as you say, and what they've been indoctrinated with, and are not willing to stand up and say, this doesn't work.
Yeah, enough. Yeah.
And we're still doing the same thing we did 50 years ago, cut it 100%. Out or radiate it. And look where that's got us, because most of us, some people manage to live a bit longer, but most of our families have gone, died.
Right. And, you know, now we are all excited about immune therapies. So now everyone's like, oh, look, this will be the change. For almost 30 years, I'm out there saying the immune system is very important in the quote unquote fight against cancer, you know, the support of a body to deal with cancer. And everyone's like, you're crazy. That's woo woo. That's totally esoteric. But now that we've monetized it, now that it is the treatment du jour in the oncology world, every single major academic institution is doing immune therapies and immune research, right? Dr. Allison, who finally won the Nobel Prize for checkpoint inhibitors, his own colleagues literally ridiculed, poo-pooed him, buried his data, ignored him, even violently opposed him for the 20, 30 years plus years he was doing this research. And yet it's his research that's now what is the standard. So I don't really care if people believe me or not. I've got the proof in the pudding of who I am and the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of patients now who will share their own experience of this. I'm not interested in the naysayers. I'm interested in the truth seekers and the solutions makers and about changing this, because to your point, really since the war on cancer was called in 1971, the same year as my birth, ironically, we have barely moved the dial in this. We might live longer after a diagnosis. That's about the only benefit we've seen in the last 50 years. Part of that is because we have earlier diagnostics, right? But no one is talking about the elephants in the living room of the doubling of cancer rates globally. No one's talking about the elephant in the living room of these brand new turbo cancers that we've all seen the last 2 or 3 years that I've been at this for decades. Nothing like this has ever happened on my watch, nor the colleagues that I work with watch. And we're all like, no one's asking questions. Luckily, people like Angus Dalglish out of the UK, you know, he wrote a big open letter saying, guys, we should probably take a better look at this. Mr. Famous oncologist, immunologist, cancer vaccine maker, by the way, like he's not an anti-vax or nothing. And he's like, take pause. No one's, you know, suddenly the man that they thought was the most brilliant, they're all now poo-pooing him, you know, things like that. But also the fastest growing cancers today, three big, big, big ones. One of them is glioblastoma. The average age, when I left medical school, the average age for The average age for glioblastoma was in 68-year-old white men. That was the demographic.
Yeah.
Today, it's under the age of 35 and everybody goes. Men, women, there's no, like, the demographic doesn't break down anymore. The second fastest growing is colorectal cancer under the age of 35. This used to be a disease considered of the aged, or people who are just atrocious, like smoking, drinking, sitting, like eating pork rinds 24/7, you know, like that used to be what they thought was colorectal cancer patients. Doesn't look like that anymore. And the third one, which we had done a pretty good job keeping it, probably the only cancer type that seemed to be responsive to standard of care, is childhood leukemias. And that is exploding in rates that we've not seen in decades and decades and decades. And so no one's asking questions about that, despite multiple studies and multiple things, just even in the last few months coming out saying, why do we have this huge explosion of cancer among the young, of a disease that used to be considered a disease of the aged? This is what drives me crazy, is no one's asking the right questions. And so that's what my job is. My job is to ask questions. My job is to get curious. My job is to test. my job, and whether that's through questionnaires, through labs, through tissue and blood biopsies, through epigenetic SNP testing, through functional medicine testing, you name it, even testing their homes, their environments, their soil, their water, knowing what they're putting in on and around them, having them go to all the different databases to look at their body care products or cleaning products, how they rate on a scale of toxicity, et cetera. That's the test. And then the assess is to start to qualify patterns. And patterns is the piece here we'll go into next, because you're like, well, what can contribute to a cancering process? And we'll knock those 10 main drops in the bucket out really fast here. And then the address, you don't even get to choose the right treatment until you know what you're dealing with, because we just jump right into treatment. And that's really a disservice to patients. We have so much of the technology today to know exactly what our patients are dealing with, and we don't use it. They might run it. They may like at places like MD Anderson or Sloan Kettering or Imperial College. They may run a tissue assay, but they'll look at it and be like, well, that's interesting. And then they'll throw it over in a pile, and then they'll still give you the same standard of care that's been given for the past 40 years.
Yeah,
on that treatment. Crazy pants, right? And then and only then, when the patient, quote unquote, their words, not mine, fails treat, which is always the treatment failing the patient, by the way, then they might go dust off. Oh, we had this from 3 years ago when we took your original tumor. Now let's try it. Oh, that didn't work. So see, these tests don't work. What they fail to tell the patient is that first of all, anytime you've had a new biopsy, your cancer can and likely will change within a couple of months of the original tissue assay. So there's that. But if you've done treatment since that initial biopsy, you've also put pressure into the system, which also changes it and creates mutations. And there's also this concept of heterogeneity of the cancer itself, so that you might get one little sample of that tumor and go, oh, this one is BRCA, MEK positive. Great. We'll give it Mechanist, which is the pharmaceutical for that. But wow, it responded a little bit, but not all the way. Well, when you really go in and look at it, you're like, oh, and there's VEGF and there's IGF and there's mTOR and there's AMP. Suddenly you realize there's a lot going on in this one tumor.
Yeah.
It's a lot of different personalities, and we keep going down the road of one target, one treatment, one target, one treatment. And we wonder why we don't get very far. And so that's where we have to expand our aperture and look at the broader field to say, well, what else could be driving this? Because we have the hallmarks of cancer, we have metabolic pathways in cancer, but what elicits those reactions? What makes those hallmarks express? What makes the genetics express? What makes the metabolomics express? And that's what I look at. So I'm not a cancer expert. I'm a terrain expert. And so I think of our body as this bucket. Okay. And even more specifically, inside of all of us, inside of all of our cells, our little organelles, little organs within our cells called the mitochondria, which are our own little bucket. And they're like the most ultimate, we think of them as just being energy factories, but they're oh so much more. These little guys are the ultimate sensors. They take in all the information putting in on and around it. Everything from literally our thoughts to our food, to our air, to our poisons, to our medications, you name it, that goes in. It translates that data and it sends signals out to the body. That's its job. So you can imagine all the opportunities for it to get jammed up. It's also the fuel we feed it, which we've also changed that drastically over the past 150 years, which you are expert on. I don't have to go down that route, which we should be a beautiful hybrid engine. We should be able to easily go in and out of like, I can burn fat. I can burn glucose. I can burn fat. I can burn glucose, whatever you want, whatever you need. But our body's like, I only know how to burn glucose. Don't give me anything else. It's not easy. And so that creates a muck in the system. And also then our mitochondria are what are in charge of apoptosis or cell program death, which means that if those mitochondria aren't working, if they're malfunctioning, if they're poor in number, or they've been destroyed by things like radiation, chemotherapy, targeted therapies, then they
general
can't-
drugs, I guess.
Exactly. Acetaminophen, one of our worst offenders. Cipro. Right? These are the two biggest offenders of our mitochondrial health. And we give out Cipro like traveler's diarrhea. Just take a Cipro, like it's candy. Same thing. Oh, got a little fever, got a little headache, got a little owie. Take an acetaminophen. Insane. Like, let's just kill the mitochondria every step of the way. So drops in the bucket, really simple. Epigenetics we talked about. So like your family potential, your blueprint, what you were born with, but you can rearrange the furniture in the room.
Yeah.
Right. Number two, the metabolic. So what are you fueling it with? Are you giving it the right nutrients? Do you have excess nutrients, deficient nutrients? Is there a mismanagement of the nutrients? Is there a genetic mismatch of your nutrients? You know, what are you feeding the cells? Number three, environment. We've already talked about a whole slew of possible toxins. No longer a matter if you're toxic, it's how bad is it? And how does it interface with your blueprint? Number four, the microbiome. Again, a few years ago, everyone literally poo-pooed, and I mean that pun specifically, the idea of the microbiome having anything to do with our health. And now, again, Nobel Prizes going in this area of research. Everyone understanding now that your chemotherapy won't even work if your microbiome isn't working. That's interesting. So maybe you should get that antibiotic before you go in and start your chemo because you've just now wasted the application of the chemo. Studies like that coming out left and right. And then we look at the immune system, which of course, if your microbiome isn't working, neither is your immune system. And I alluded to those three R's in the beginning, recognize, respond, remember. None of us have a, you know, really, unless you work very hard at it, you're missing at least one of those three R's today. We just had a global pandemic that really highlighted that. The types of food we eat or don't eat today, we're really deficient in all the fat-soluble nutrients that are very, very important for maintaining our immune system. So whether you're on a low-fat craze or you're on pharmaceuticals that wipe out your fat-soluble nutrients like vitamin D, K, and A, which are critical for cell differentiation, for HDAC inhibition, epigenetic expression, cancer prevention, you name it, we're all deficient in those. And then you look at inflammation, holy schmoly pants, like that is like, we call ourselves the inflammation nation these days. Then we look at circulation and oxygenation, which is kind of one category in and of itself. We know that cancer likes to grow in a hypoxic environment. And so we are all malperfused and low oxygen, hypoxic. Most of us don't move our bodies enough, you know, or over move our bodies. Then we look at hormone, like we swim in a hormonal milieu swimming pool today of just exogenous hormones from xenotoxins, from pesticides to body care products, to the plastics. You know, we eat an average of a credit card a week, by the way, that's how much plastic we're all getting today, which is an absolute endocrine hormonal disruptor. And then we look at stress and circadian rhythm response, which, you know, if you're looking, that's why I got these ridiculous grandma glasses on.
They look blockers. Cool.
Thank you. My blue blocking, I've got this cool, like, this is kind of fun. If I can get it off here. This little guy is a magnetic thing that goes on to my computer, another layer on top of the internal devices on my computer to lower my EMS. I'm standing on a grounding mat. I should probably put on my tinfoil hat next. I make sure I turn off my lights, you know, the circadian rhythm of making sure that red light after sunset and before sunrise. And then the final one is mental emotional. No one ever wants to talk about that one. It's usually the last drop in the bucket, but it's also one of the most important because guess what? When you're in a state of duress, when you're in a state of fear, your cortisol is at a level that does not allow you to heal. Your vagal nerve is fired off that you're not allowed able to receive whatever therapies you're putting on board. And so these drops in the bucket, we're able to assess with each and every patient, which drop is priority or which handful of drops are priority. So we know where to start in these folks, and we can help them understand what got their cancer activated and what can bring it back into management. And then we just take that from one step at a time and retest and reassess and just keep pushing it one step forward at a time.
Yeah. So for everybody, one of those 10 things is probably going to be more dominant than another one. So everybody's going to have a different dominance that's coming through.
Exactly. And that's what in the front of our book, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer, there's a little questionnaire of these terrain 10 to kind of help you. It's a very simple one, like 10 questions for each section. It has a very simple starting point for you to get curious and then maybe just go fast forward and just read your chapter that's the priority. But we also, if you go to our website, mtih.org, which stands for Metabolic Terrain Institute of Health.org, which is our nonprofit education, research, as well as eventually treatment hospital. This has a more in-depth, much more detailed intake for you to then really know what's driving your cellular derangement, what's making you truly vulnerable to. And so it really gets you, it's even a weighted questionnaire. So you really can say, wow, these are my top three, and this is where I really need to be working. Because so many patients will even say things to me like, but I don't understand why my friend, she runs marathons and she's a vegan and she attends yoga classes. Why does she have cancer? I'm like, it's probably because of all those three things I just listed. And people always freak out when I say that. I'm like, Well, if she's got, say, MTHFR, for instance, she doesn't methylate. So you don't get your methylating support from a vegan diet. So if you've got methylation SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, and you're eating a diet that did not give you all of the building blocks to methylate and detoxify, you're effed. Like, you're just in trouble on this planet today. And then if you overexercise, your cortisol is off the charts high. Your tissue destruction and oxidative stress is super elevated. Your inflammation is really elevated. And then your insulin responds to that, to the inflammation and the cortisol. So now you are a metabolic nightmare.
Yeah.
And then if you're a carb junkie, on top of it, you've added another insult to injury. And so people, like, the ideas of what we qualify as healthy today need to be re-examined.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And so one of the things in the book that with the questionnaire that threw me was, have you ever?
Hmm.
So then the answer is going to be 9 times out of 10, yes.
Yeah. Well,
so
that's
how realistic is that when you say, have you ever, which might have been 40
sure.
years ago. I don't know.
Sure. Well, what's really nice is that in the book is just like, we just want to get your wheels turning. Because the way we even ask our questions, there's questions that people would never normally think is a problem. There's a lot of things we ask here. And by design, we're like, you probably don't think about those scented candles in your house, or how many hours a day you spend sitting, mm-hmm. or dryer sheets, or coloring your hair, or dilapidating, any furry things on your face if you're a woman type of thing, like things like that. People don't think about those. So that is more of a compelling, getting people thinking, getting them curious. But in the deeper dive, more specific one I just described that's on our website, it breaks it down and qualifies it way more specifically. So you can get really real to understand, for instance, like one of these days when it comes out, that it'll come out, it'll show, like, basically if you've had more than 10 rounds of antibiotics in your entire life, your likelihood of having chronic illness and cancer goes up exponentially. That's not my statistic. That's CDC and all the others, at power to be, that have done the research on this. So we're getting people to start thinking about, oh, I need to be thinking about this, or the fact that 5 CTC scans in your life is the same as the equivalent of radiation that you would have gotten from Hiroshima. For instance, no one thinks about that. They're like, oh, I'm due for my 3-month CT scan again. Here we go. And wondering why their cancer continues to proliferate. It's like, well, your DNA is completely nuked now, and now we cannot repair you. And now your cancer is a galloping goose. And so folks don't know that. So in our more detailed dive in, we do qualify that and break it down to wait out, like, hey, if this was within the last year or two, this is probably more important to consider than if it was 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. So things like that. So, but the book, as any book, you have to kind of meet the masses where they are. And given that it's so second nature for somebody like me, and probably even for you, Jackie, and probably even a lot of your listeners who I'm assuming are quite savvy and sophisticated consumers, we're writing that book for the 98% that aren't.
Yeah.
That's about the, let me show you what you think, what you perceive, like everyone thinking their oaties, their oatmeal every day is healthy. This is going to really upset all the UK. You waiting for them? Like, oh, I'll get the hate mail here. If you want to talk about the most glyphosate oxalate drenched food on the planet, I can't think of a more processed and toxic food group. Like, it's really sad that this is what we call the Heart Healthy Association, and like the vegan community, like everyone's like, this is the best thing since sliced bread. I'm like, well, it's poisonous sliced bread, but that's the place here that you get the hate mail of this. It's like, I'm not telling you anything that's not well articulated in the literature that you can't know for yourself. And so if people don't believe me, and let's say they're eating a lot of these foods that they perceive are superfoods that they ingest on a regular basis, that's when they can go and run their labs, right?
Yeah.
Go and run your glyphosate level. Easy to get your hands on a glyphosate test these days, even online, really inexpensive. The highest levels of glyphosate I see are in patients who eat a high diet in legumes and grains, even organic, because there's, by nature, these plants chelate glyphosate out of the soil, which means it's in their bodies that we then ingest.
Yes.
And then it kicks up ours. People don't like hearing that, but that's, I'm just the messenger.
And yeah. It was a while ago, I read or heard that some of the toxins that have been banned since the 70s can still be found in our bodies.
Yeah, they're called persistent chemicals. And there are certain things like the ones that make things like Teflon, they stay around forever unless you very thoughtfully, actively work with someone who's been trained, done extreme training in environmental medicine and toxicology, who knows how to safely chelate that out of your body. Because if you just try and go and start to chelate it on your own, you will shut your kidneys down, right? Like this is not, oh, I'm going to do it yourselfer on this one. Nope. And so there are lots of tests out there to actually check for the type of chemical exposures you get from day to day versus the type of forever chemicals that you're alluding to, which are these persistent chemicals. You can test for that. There's actually a company out of France, Kudzu Science, KUDZU Science.com. When you go, at least in the US, when I go on, it will translate from French to English. But you can also do a, you know, if you've got one of those things, it'll translate it for you. But they actually have, like, you can wear a silicone wristband for a week and send it back in, and it'll tell you what you're being exposed to in your day to day, in your home, your work, your school. Pretty frightening. They also have other test kits to like test the soil and the water in your environment, but you can also test your body and you can find those permanent, you know, those persistent versus those more acute exposures. And then you get to determine, what do I need to do with this? So for instance, if you see high lead, well, that's when you start to go, am I in an old house with a lot of lead paint? It's chipping off that I'm inhaling its residue. Am I drinking still from lead pipes? Is there a lot of lead in my soil? Because maybe I'm living near gas plants, things like that. Near, I live near a gas station, you know, where those things really sequester into the soil. Even though we've taken the lead out of our gasoline, there's still persistence in our environment from that. So those are just examples that you can find the source of contamination and remove it, you know, avoid it, remove it, mitigate it, and get it out of your body.
Yeah. It's massive, isn't it?
It is massive. And that's why we created a roadmap to be like, you got to start somewhere. Because when we get that paralysis by analysis, because it's so overwhelming, anything helps, guys.
Yeah.
Anything helps.
I'm just thinking about, you know, where I've come from, because although I've been keto low carb for the last 7 years, my journey started way before that. Probably when my kids were about 18 months old or two, they had loads of antibiotics. They and I had loads of antibiotics when they were babies. And I just went to a homeopath and I started on a homeopathic journey. So they have hardly ever had Calpol. I don't know how many bottles I've bought and thrown away without even opening them. I think I probably haven't had any paracetamol or anything like that for about 10 years.
Yes.
I put up with the pain. I've had days of toothaches where I've just sat with my head in my hand and migraines, and I just push through it and I don't take anything, and everyone thinks I'm mad. But I just keep thinking, I don't want to be putting that stuff in my body that, yeah, maybe it does some good, but maybe it doesn't.
Yeah, there's always a price to pay, right? The short-term benefit may not outweigh the long-term detriment. And those are the things that are always like, there's a time and a place for these interventions, right? Absolutely. But when we are, they're our go-to, we got to rethink that strategy.
Yeah.
Right? Have to.
My kid's not sleeping at night. Let me give him some Calpol. They didn't have any. I remember Alex as a babe, he was quite young and he had a problem with his ears, and I just wouldn't give him anything, and he was probably in a lot of pain. And they wanted to put grommets in, and I said no, and I just kept no. Whether that's a good thing or not, I don't know. But you know, now that they're of an age where they do what they want and it's up to them, you know, I can't stop them. But up until they were 17, 18, they didn't have that stuff.
Yeah. You probably gave them a nice little runway of starting to build their own terrain and fortify themselves, so that when they do go out on their own, figure it out, because they have to, it's part of our individuation here. But you know, like when I had my private practice, when families came to me and their kids had I would teach them, okay, we got to keep the fever going. So we don't ever suppress it. If it's above 105.2 Fahrenheit, I don't quite know. I think that's around, gosh, I'm trying to think here, 43, 44 Celsius.
Yeah.
something in that zone. I'm like, if it's longer, if it hangs out at that temperature for longer than an hour or two, then you call me. Otherwise, here are the strategies. When they're uncomfortable, they're going to be uncomfortable. You can put them in tepid baths. You can put ice packs in the back of their neck and the bottom of their feet. You can use homeopathic belladonna. If the remedy came, if the fever came on fast, you can use homeopathic ferrum fos. If it came on really slow, you can, you know, just put like, you could just like really nourish them, cuddle them. Like that's another one, like really kind of distract them with these other things. You can do wet sock therapy. If they've got a raging ear infection that's screaming, you can cut a yellow onion in half, warm it in a microwave, which is not preferable, but at least you're not eating that and eating that deranged, but heat that thing, put it in a little cheesecloth and hold that open cut end of the onion to the ear. I swear to God, as sound as crazy and woo-woo as that is, the quercetin of the yellow onion and the steam of that goes right into the ear. The warmth of it opens up the eustachian tube and the pain goes away. Like you'll have a screaming baby or toddler and it goes, it's like magic. I mean, parents think I had a, they thought I was a witch. I'm pretty sure of the weird things I'd have them do with wet sock therapies and stuff. There are always ways to support people through this process. Ironically, as an adult, if I have a patient, a doctor, excuse me, a client who's fevering, but adults, we don't get to this high as our kiddos do, right? We might get to like 100, 101 and we feel like death. Like we're like, please kill me now. What I actually encourage those guys who get in the hottest bath you can handle, drink Yarrow tea, drink ginger tea, get into a sauna, sweat it out, push it. It will actually break the fever and you will feel better. These go completely against what we were all taught in med school and nursing school and pediatrics, the whole bit. And yet this is why our immune systems no longer work, is because we have been suppressing its divine, you know, work, like what it's been, what it was designed to do all along. You mentioned about, so it's like, there's the fever suppression piece, but pain itself is a messenger, guys. It's telling you this is inflammation. Acute pain is good. That is not like good. It's not fun. No one wants it, but that's like the body is sending off these cytokines to go to an area to heal it. When you prevent that, when you stave that off with something like a steroid, you just keep, you create a never ending chronic wound that won't properly heal.
Yeah.
When you allow the body to do its own like explosion and like deal with it, it gets it all the way through the process. It's just that, a process. Now, obviously all these things I'm talking about here, please work with a professional who has been trained in this way. There are bioregulatory physicians, there are naturopathic physicians, there are homeopathic physicians, there are Ayurvedic and Chinese medicine doctors, there are functional medicine doctors, there are anthroposophical doctors who all have really good training and understanding of this concept of terrain.
Yeah.
Where we are supporting the body to do what it was designed to do, but we're doing it. Those folks who have proper training, we also know what to watch for. So if there's something that is urgent that needs that proper intervention of suppression, whatever that may be, we know when that's appropriate too. Because I've also seen people be like, oh, I did it totally naturally. And then they died of acute abdominal issue or something. It's like, no, there's, you know, common sense here too, guys. So that's the place, is you don't try and do it yourself or on these types of things. You want a trained professional to help you through these challenging storms.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the other thing is a lot of people just want the easy route. It's easy to take some Calpol or some paracetamol or something. You know, God knows how many nights I spent just sitting beside my kids' beds, putting a cold flannel on the back of their necks just to try and keep their head cool and let the fever rage in their body.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, this is what they need to do. And then homeopathic remedies for me was what helped. And I always had a homeopath or a homeopathic helpline
Wow.
that I could phone at any time.
Amazing.
But it's hard work. And some people just don't want the hard work.
Exactly. No one wants the hard work. But what happens is people go the default easy button first, and they usually end up having to see me later and do the hard work anyway. So it's like, you do the hard work now, or you'll have to do it later,
yeah,
eventually. Right. And so that is what's challenging. And no one wants to hear that side. But you know, there was a time 30 years ago when the old adage of everything in moderation, including moderation, well, sadly, on the planet we live on today, that is no longer the case. You have to be more eyes wide open. You have to be a self-advocate. You also have to be an activist on this planet today. As much as people do not want to do that, we don't have a choice. As I said before, no one is coming to do this for you. And so You have to start somewhere. In fact, I really hate that the book is called The Metabolic Approach to Cancer. My husband's always like, it should be called The Metabolic Approach to Life or Prevention or Wellness. Because this is like, what's going to happen here is your listeners are going to hear this and be like, I don't have cancer, so I don't worry about it. And like walk out of the room, right?
Yeah.
You need to listen to this now so you don't have cancer. Because as I said, you got a 50-50, you got a flip of a coin, right? And so it's not, this isn't a scare tactic. It's a please don't wait tactic. And here's the sad part. Human nature is that no one is compelled to get curious, to dig deeper, to do the work, and to make the changes necessary until their literal freaking lives depend on it.
Yeah.
The soon as someone figures out how to compel people to truly prevent, as soon as they do, I want to know who that person is. I want to bottle it. I want to pour it all over my communities all over the globe. Because the reality is people look at me and they look at my husband like, oh, I could never do what you do. Now, first of all, anyone who's ever come over, traveled with me, who's ever come over to my house for dinner, whoever follows me to the farmer's market, or just sees the way I live, not a single person would ever say, oh, poor her. It's so hard. Not even. It is such a joy. It is so much fun. It's so much fun. We live down here in Mexico and we go out to eat. You know, the default is bring the bread, bring the tortilla chips to the table. And we always like our restaurants know us well enough. No one brings those things to our table. And if they do, if there's a new person or we're in a new restaurant, we educate them very quickly. Like, no, thank you. Most of the time they don't ask questions, but when they do, we give them, we teach them, we educate them, and then we inspire them and they make the changes, which is super cool. But they'll bring like a plate of cut up radishes or cut up cucumbers or cut up, you know, suddenly our salsa and our guacamole and our dips, that's how we're eating it. No. And then when we have like the little kids on the beach that are the vendors on the beach, they're super poor. They know when they come and sit with us, they're not getting French fries. They're not getting chips. They're not getting burger buns. They're getting these other things. It's like, you don't need any more glyphosate in your diet. Cause I know when you go home tonight, you will have all of that that you could possibly want more. So here's your one square meal. Where I know you're getting veggies. I know you're getting solid, clean protein and some quality fats. We educate every restaurant we go to. We're like, what kind of oils do you use? Right? You use canola or seed corn oil. We're not eating that. We'll grill instead. I know how to, you know, like down there, they don't do the high heat. They don't char the crap out of things, but it's like, those are the things you have to now take advantage of. So if you have a few favorite restaurants, start to educate them. In my town in Durango, Colorado, I got to educate like all, they hated me for years. I'm like, everybody needs to get some gluten-free options on the menu. Now you need to have some paleo. Now you need to have some keto options on the menu. Now you have to think about your seed oils. I would go to my favorite sushi place and bring my own bottle of coconut aminos that they live in the fridge with my name on it that I'd come to restaurant and like, here's Nisha's special coconut aminos because I can't do the soy. Like, hilarious that it became a thing that now the restaurateurs send me updates to their menu. Like they come to me saying, look at what we've created with excitement, with pride, with enthusiasm, and they're getting clients and customers because of it. Where they first thought I was a pain in the ass, they now see me as an asset. So pain in the asset. And so that's how we work towards it. It's the bridge to that. Be the pain in the asset in all your environments. That's my encouragement to your listeners is to advocate for yourself.
Yeah.
That's the only way we can change things because guess what? Nothing in the industry is going to change unless the consumer demands it.
Yeah.
I can be the
we always say that.
Yeah, it's true.
It has to you come from the ground roots up.
Absolutely. And this is what you're creating here with this podcast and the followers you bring on. They are already the grassroots people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because without them, you know, we'd just be a few voices in the wilderness.
And so I was that for a very long time. So it's really nice to have other voices in the choir now.
Yeah. So how do we educate the people that believe that doctors know best, oncologists know best? Do we just leave them be to carry on with their radiation and cutting out, or is there anything we can do to help people just even incorporate some of this stuff?
Such a good question. Now, first of all, I want to be very, very clear that I am not against standard of care. I just think it's not being done well and we can do a lot better. So for instance, I just was advising on a client this week who has 4 lesions in his brain. He needs some spot radiation because it's pushing against some valuable real estate, but we are before he goes in, he's going to do an HBOT, a hyperbaric oxygen treatment. So he's going to, what he's going to do is he's going to basically open up the pores into the cancer cell. He lowers the hypoxic state of the tumor microenvironment itself, which makes it more vulnerable to whatever treatment. We also have him going into that radiation treatment fasted, deeply fasted with a level of ketones in his blood before he goes in. And 20 to 30 minutes before he goes into the gamma knife radiation, he will take a bump of exogenous ketones. We also have him taking high doses of melatonin, which radiosensitizes his cancer cells to the radiation and protects as a beautiful cloak to the healthy cells around it and outside of the tumor microbed. So he will then, because it's a one and done, it's just a single one day gamma knife thing. That's what he's doing to prepare for that. And then what we do is we maintain his ketosis for months, if not forever, after this, because he's got some other, this is metastatic lung cancer into his brain. So he's a non-small cell lung carcinoma, by the way, in his 30s, right? So we've been talking about the younger and younger, not a smoker, like not, that's a whole nother story. But this guy, like this is where we are, and he's at UCSF, a well-known, high-respected cancer center and academic institution in Southern California, right? So we are making standard of care work better for him and protecting his healthy cells simultaneously. So when people start to listen to me from that community, they start to realize I am their friend and I am not their foe. I make them look better at the end of the day. I make their jobs more exciting again, because I tell you, one of the biggest burnouts and one of the highest suicide rates are among oncologists. So they are suffering people. They are suffering.
Yeah.
And so this helps them get excited and creative and curious about their own work again. And when they see their patients doing better, they get curious and they want to know why. Not all of them do. Some of them just like, don't tell me. No, but go on. Same thing with chemotherapy. Today, we can actually do a blood or a tissue biopsy and know precisely what your targets are to even see if the chemotherapy that's being offered is a fit. Do you have the targets for that drug? If you don't, why the F are we using that drug? Right. Yeah. Let's look at what targets you do have and let's reassess that. The other thing we do with that is we say, okay, you're normally getting a maximum tolerated dose, which is the old school approach to chemotherapy, which is basically napalm the field and hope that a few little things come back alive, you know, that you want to come back alive. We are moving into an era known as the adaptive theory of cancer, where you push it back just enough so that the rest of the body's resources can swoop in and finish the job, such as a functioning immune system, a functioning microbiome. Right. So now we can say, let's use anywhere from 20% or less of the typical dose of the chemotherapy based on the target, the information we have from this testing. So we can get very sensitive, like a chemo, like what you would do, like a culture insensitivity for a urinary tract infection to say, I have this organism. So therefore this drug will work on it. Same thing we're able to do now in cancer. So now we know exactly what tool we need. We can use a lower dose of it and we can potentiate that dose with other therapeutic interventions. So for instance, things like carboplatin is potentiated with actually an old school antibiotic called doxycycline. So you can actually bring in doxycycline with a lower dose of the platinum drugs and enhance its activity while protecting the healthy cells. From nature, if people can't tolerate the doxycycline, we can use usnea, which is the plant, the gold man's beard herb that doxycycline was made from. So we actually have a natural compound that is what created doxycycline. So just to give examples of how we can make standard of care work better. So I say this so that your listeners understand it's not either or. I don't have to choose alternative or standard of care. It should be an absolute bridge always, that should be the standard for everybody. So there's that piece. When people are like, well, where do I start? Also in the book, there is I can't remember, it's early on in the first chapter, 10 questions to ask your oncologist. That's a great place to start.
Yeah.
Because if they can't answer those questions, you need a different oncologist. And I appreciate that there are healthcare systems that are stacked and you might be waiting for months. Go private. I'm telling you right now, if you care about living, that's the only way you're going to get through this. Find the way. In the U.S., we have to both pay for our healthcare system as well as pay to go out of the system. You guys have your healthcare system covered and then have to pay to go out of the system. Well, you have it better than we do. So figure the F out, just like we do here. We have GoFundMe sites. We refinance our homes. We do life insurance policy flips. You do whatever it takes to survive. Someday that will change. That's what my mission is. My mission and vision is to create this that I'm talking about to make it accessible to everyone. no matter your demographic, no matter your financial status, no matter any of the things. This should be standard of care, and that is what we're building. But until then, I wouldn't be in front of you had I not stepped out of the system.
Yeah.
Right? Most of the patients I've worked with, especially if they're stage four, would not be here if they had not stepped out of the system. So if you're expecting that the system will fix you, will save you, that's your first step, is to realize that ain't the case. Very, very frequently is it the case. So to at least get curious and creative, and make sure you even like the doctor that you work with, because the rapport, the relationship is just as much medicine as whatever tool they use to treat your cancer.
Yeah.
The mindset, if they don't believe that you're going to survive, you're not going to survive. They've already put that field on top of you.
Right? Words are so powerful.
Oof, so powerful. How many of you know someone that said, I'm sorry, you got 3 months to live, and they lived to that 3 months, like right to the T. Even though you might be looking like, you can do so much more. It's so maddening. Like we just talked about this before we came on, of like looking at someone to say, you've been given this diagnosis, you've been given this prognosis, and you're sort of like, I'll just sit here and let them do to me whatever and not question it and not do anything more. For those of us who know there's more to do, it is incredibly painful for us to sit by quietly to watch that. Just so you guys know, who are willing to just sit there and like, just do it to me, whatever. It is incredibly disturbing when you know what can be done differently, right? And so that's where someday my hope, and it's thanks to the Jackie Fletchers of the world and others who are allowing these types of conversations to be had, even if they're perceived as controversial. You guys, I'm not doing anything controversial. It is 100% data-driven. I am basing it on the very studies that they completely ignore of the things I'm talking to you about. This is an opportunity and a call to action for each of you to demand a different way of treating yourselves and those that you love.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm very aware of your time. Thank you so much for being with us for so long. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would have wanted to say or feel like you want to share with our listeners?
I'm just so grateful that you speak to the, you know, most people want me to spend a lot of time talking about keto, you know, and I love that this is a savvy community that likely knows so much about it, but I just would like them to know, if they're not savvy to the cancer conversation with regards to keto, that the hallmarks of cancer, that there's these like, why does cancer express, or where, how does it express? One of the cool things in our studies, it shows that ketone bodies directly impact each of the hallmarks of cancer. That's super exciting. We don't have a single pharmaceutical that targets more than 1 to 3 at most of those hallmarks at any given time. And you have one lifestyle modification that targets all of them simultaneously. I just want people listening here to realize you guys are superheroes with that information just for yourselves right now. So that, and then the final thought is, I just hope that anyone listening recognizes that they are far more powerful than they've been led to believe, and that it is up to you to get curious, to dig deeper, to look under the hood, and to test and assess your own terrain to know what your blind spots are, so you can thoughtfully, intentionally work on them so that you don't ever have to see somebody like me.
Yeah, cool. So one thing I was going to say is I interviewed Dr. Matt Calkins or Calkins, and one of the things he said was there could not be a single pill that did everything like the ketogenic diet does, which is just echoes what you're saying, really.
That gives me goosebumps. It pulls all the levers, pushes all the buttons, upregulates the genetics that need to be expressed, downregulates those that don't, and everything in between. It sets this, it creates a vulnerability in the field that the healthy cells get stronger and the cancer cells get weaker, which is also such a powerful strategy, so that whatever therapeutic interventions you bring on board, it's like a, you know, chariot, you know, that the whole Trojan horse coming in, that makes those cancer cells far more easy to target. So if nothing else, just to know that is incredibly powerful information.
So is there a level of ketones that people should be aiming for? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, what's really cool is the studies show that basically any amount, you know, so like a nutritional ketosis is 0.8 to 2 millimoles, right? That's like a good, like, hey, I did a little fast overnight, you know, I'm eating low carb, I'm hanging out there. When you push it into therapeutic, which is getting above the levels of 2 millimoles, that's when you are actually starting to harness it and actually turn it into a treatment, like a cancer treatment, a chemotherapy, an epileptic target, a depression target, whatever. When you turn it into that level, you become a pharmaceutical with it. And so there are certain things like brain tumors, for instance, I would like them to be at the higher level of therapeutic ketosis, right? Put in more stress, be in a therapeutic state of ketosis when you do things like radiation, hyperbaric oxygen, high dose IV vitamin C, hyperthermia. When you go into any of your oxidative therapies, the higher your ketones, the higher your oxidative stress, which is a cytotoxic effect. Cancer cells die under that cytotoxic load. And so you potentiate the cytotoxic effect because at the high levels of ketones are cytotoxic. So yeah, that's a really great question. And then those who just want to, or in maintenance, like even just cycling in and out of even nutritional ketosis. So doing something like maybe I have all my patients, no matter what, who you are, cancer or not cancer, 13 hours fasting every single day, period. Done. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Then if you want to push it a little bit, 16 to 18 hours twice a week, that's a little bit of, let's take out some garbage, a little mitophagy. Great. Then if you want to push it and actually reconstruct your microbiome, your immune system, and really push the antes of cleanup and longevity, then you do 3 days a month of fasting. And then for people like Dr. Walter Longo and Dr. Thomas Seyfried out of Boston College, who's one of the premier experts in cancer and keto, they say if you do 1 5-to-10-day water fast annually, you can lower your risk of cancer by 70%. Mind-boggling. I'd like to see the data where they're pulling that, but they've both repeated it. And the longevity research has uttered this, but that's something you can look at. I myself do a 3-to-5-day water fast every single month. Half for years. It's just part of my routine. And especially when I'm traveling, I try and organize, because I hate eating on the road, stuff like that. I just feel terrible. I get easily poisoned. I've got celiac, I've got a corn allergy, like all these things. So for me, I like to strategize it around when I'm traveling, when I don't want to eat, because I don't want to get poisoned. So those are really easy things to do. So yeah, there's levels that you could take this, and it has a different mechanism of action depending on the depth in which you're in ketosis, or the depth in which you're in a state of deep fasted state, which is going to kick up your ketones. Yeah.
Thank you. So how can people get in contact with you, find out more?
Sure.
Want to find an advocate or a doctor?
Well, please go check out the best place, which is kind of like the container for it all, is mtih.org, which stands for Metabolic Terrain Institute of Health. .org. Even if you Googled Metabolic Terrain Institute of Health, you'll find that. You can also go to drnasha.com. They cross-pollinate between each other. We're getting ready to update both websites. So watch, but both of them have a ton of free downloaded information as well. You'll see information about my books, MTA, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer, and also the book Mistletoe and the Emerging Future of Integrative Oncology. I've also had the privilege to contribute to several other books on things like on low-dose naltrexone, written forwards of other cancer books, including a pediatric oncology book coming out this year. And I've also helped contribute to a fasting chapter on cancer in the new Noakes Foundation Nutrition Network textbook on carbohydrate restriction and ketosis. So I'm really prolific in that arena. We also launched a podcast ourselves. We'll get Jackie on there. It's called Metabolic Matters. So go take a look. We just launched it in October, and we've only launched 2 a month since then. So we have just a handful of amazing people, but probably a lot of crossover for your audience. People like Georgia Ead, whose new book, Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind, just came out. We've had Zach Bush. We've had, my brain is just like frying right now of who's on there, but so much about the metabolic health space in general, from everything from mind body to epigenetics to tissue assay testing, everything in between, that will continue. And then, yeah, just follow us there. Follow us in those environments on social. All the handles that I mentioned will take you to those places to see what events we've got. I spend a lot of time speaking and lecturing all over the world. I'll be spending almost 6 weeks in Europe and the UK this summer, 2024.
Hopefully I get to see you again then.
I hope so, Jackie. That would be great. At IPM, ICNM, HOS, which is the Health Optimization Biohacker Summit, Keto Live Summit in Switzerland. There's a lot of beautiful activity in the metabolic space. So I hope to see you and your listeners there as well. And just thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation. I love what you're doing, and I hope we get to have conversations like this more in the future.
Thank you. So before we go, have you got time to give us your 3 top tips
Oh, okay. As to specifically anything in particular?
Anything you like.
Okay. So these are kind of my non-negotiable dailies. And so I have this hack that I do every morning, which are kind of my top three that come together, which is I watch that sunrise every single morning. Okay. So that's
Yeah.
my non-negotiable. Wherever I am on the planet, that's what I do. So I get up and adjust accordingly in my time zones. At my house, I can also pair that with sitting up my on my balcony. I have one of those little portable saunas, like those little zipper up tents. So my sauna faces the direction of the sunrise. So
Okay.
I will sit in there and I will practice my either relaxer breather, relaxinator breather, which is a CO2 processing breathing thing that kind of is like a Wim Hof-esque breathing process that I can do simultaneously in that. And I meditate. So those are my daily start my day off right. Get my metabolic health right from the get-go and get my circadian rhythm and my pineal gland hormonal axes on track before the day even begins. And I do not touch my electronics. I do not touch food. I do not touch anything but some water for at least the first 3 hours that I am awake every day so I can let all of this other goodness distill in. So those are kind of more than three tips, but the essence that you can stack. And you can consolidate because I'm a you can multitask with this because we're all busy people. So whatever I can sort of stack simultaneously, which works really well for my life and my lifestyle, I really set the tone for how my day unfolds after that.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank
Thank you
you.
so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It would be great if you could support us through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/fabulouslyketo and you can choose the monthly amount you wish.
Can you recommend a guest we can interview? If you can, click on the link in the show notes to send us your recommendation.
Would you like to join our Facebook group? Search for Fabulously Keto on Facebook. Our Facebook page is called Fabulously Keto and you can follow us there. Or you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is Fabulously Keto. Or follow us on Instagram, Fabulously Keto 1. Did you enjoy the show? Let us know you listened by tagging us in your Insta story or Instagram post using the handle FabulouslyKeto1 and the hashtag TFKP. All the links are on the website and in the show notes.
If you haven't subscribed to the podcast, click the subscribe button. Reviews help us to be found and reach new listeners. Please leave a review of our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. We appreciate you taking the time and read them all.
Disclaimer: the information in this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. Nothing in this podcast can be taken as advice. Whether our guests are doctors, healthcare professionals or not, they're only sharing their own opinions and stories. And this does not constitute a doctor-patient relationship. It's always best to seek professional medical advice should you wish to make any changes to your current medication or treatments. Also, speak to your own doctor if you have any concerns about your health or you wish to make lifestyle changes, especially if you're taking medication.